We get a lot of our speakers from Feed First through in Quakertown, right? Is that where it is?
I understand, but we found out about Justine, it is, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Through that group. And I've asked like three times how to pronounce the name of the town you're from. It's Chalfont? Chalfont? I usually don't hear of a town I haven't heard of before, but there's one. Welcome, Justine. It's
What?
In Chalfont, your home. Oh, that's right. Fun. What's it?
Monday.
Monday. What is it?
Monday Funday.
Monday Funday.
I didn't name it, but I have to say it all the time. So I see the clock, but I can't really see the clock, so I have my phone up here, so it's not personal. I just need to know the time. Anyway, my name is Justine. I am an alcoholic. And I can feel my heart beating really fast, and I have to remember to kind of let God make that stop. So what can I tell you? I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I am a sponsor. I put my hand out, and I do whatever is asked of me in this program. I give back to it every day, and I am grateful for it in every moment. So saying that, I'm going to tell you what it was like and what it's like now. And I'm going to tell you how I got here. So my, you know, I'm just going to tell you a little weird thing that happened the other day. I was thinking about amends and how I'm making amends, and I feel like I'm really on track, and then I'm like remembering stuff, and I think we all have that experience. You remember stuff so late in the game, and I guess that's going to happen because so much of my life is a fog. And I recently remembered this moment. I had this great relationship with my parents, and I've made amends to my parents, and they did try to let me off the hook, and I didn't let that happen. But recently, I had this memory where I owe my mother an amends, and I'm terrified that if I make this amends to her, it's going to upset her because she's 70. But just a little weird thing. When I was, I think, 17 years old, I got really drunk and high or something, and I came home with a friend. Don't remember really any of it, but I remember in the morning my mother coming into my room and saying to me, "There's someone dead in the bathroom." And I thought to myself, "There's someone dead in the bathroom? What does this have to do with me?" And then I went downstairs, and I'm looking in the bathroom, and you can't open the door because somebody's foot is in the bathroom. I'm like, "Oh, there is someone dead in the bathroom." And I had no idea what it was. It was a friend of mine passed out on the bathroom floor. But I'm thinking, should I make an amends for that? I don't know. Anyway, so just little things that come back to me that kind of shake me up a little bit as I go. Tell you a little bit about my childhood. My parents, Ron and Amelia, wonderful people, pretty spiritually sick. I grew up in North Jersey. Typical. I am, as I've stated many times, I am the third child in a two-children household. And I was made very aware of that from a very young age, that I was really not, I was draining the resources. I was grossly ignored, and it wasn't because they hated me. It was because they were busy. And I like to kind of put this out there. There is significant sexual abuse in my story. It happened when I was 6 years old till I was about 10 years old. And I've used that piece of information as an excuse to do horrible things through my life. So I try not to live in it. It's hard to not live in that because that kind of stuff shapes you. I have very confused ideas about sex and love and what those things mean. And that's something I'm growing and learning from, but I try not to address it too much in my story or in my life. I have a very vivid memory of myself in a yellow dress in a field with my sister, and it is a beautiful memory, and it's the last beautiful memory that I have. I think I might have been 5. So, all right, so this bad thing happens to me when I'm 6, and then all of a sudden it kind of shapes and changes everything, and I'm constantly looking at myself feeling ugly, unattractive, unlovable. And it started to really carry itself through my life until I took that first drink. I took my first drink when I was 11. I got blackout drunk. I vomited. I wore vomit in my hair for 2 days because I was incapable of taking a shower. My parents really didn't notice because who would think their 11-year-old was drunk? And that didn't really amount to anything or turn it into anything because most 11-year-olds don't really have alcohol got the alcohol from a 16-year-old at a slumber party. And I don't remember it making me feel better or worse. I just remember it making me feel sick. And so that was, I think that was eighth grade. My parents moved us when I was in ninth grade, and that is social suicide. I don't know if any of you have moved during that time in your life. So we moved to this town that's two towns from where the town I am originally. I'm originally from Livingston, and we moved to a different county, a different town, where all the Italians lived. And I like to kind of describe it as everyone having a Mary on the half shell on the front lawn, so you knew we were Italians. And we fit in there, and I fit in there, but I still, you know, moved to this town in this time where I wasn't going to the high school where they marry two schools. So I was the new kid. No matter what I did, I was the new kid. And I felt nervous. I remember getting on the bus the first day, and I tried so hard to look cool, and I just didn't. It didn't really work. But I made this decision I was going to be the smart kid in the new town because maybe here I could be this, whatever. So I was given some information that I was going to have to take this test and know all the 50 capitals of the 50 states, and I was going to ace this. And I aced it, and I was instantly hated. And so I was like, all right, this isn't going to work, so I'm not going to do that. And then I decided I was going to be the kid with the booze because I had this little idea that the kid with the booze is going to be the cool kid, so I want to be the cool kid. And that's what I became. I didn't have a whole lot of experience drinking and doing drugs, just here and there. I think I got high when I was 12. I drank on occasion, but I was always a kid who had alcohol because I wanted you to like me. So fast forward a little bit. I'm now really popular and everybody loves me and I'm funny and I can be me. And that's another thing. I think I'm hilarious. It may not be accurate, but that's what I think. And so that's what I'm going to be. And if I'm funny, you'll like me. And I don't even know if I'm really funny. I'm just trying so hard to be funny. So I'm funny. I'm going to parties. People like me. I have all these people who like me. I'm failing high school. I don't care about that at all. But all of a sudden, I feel like I have tons of people surrounding me and absolutely no friends. It was an extremely lonely place because I'm not me. I'm just giving you what I think you're going to like. My first experience of AA was at 14, and I wasn't ready, clearly, and we'll get to all that mess. One of my cousins had come to my parents' house and thought that there was something a little off about me, so she searched my bedroom and she found some pills. And my parents called my high school, and they had my locker checked, and they found every medication that my family collectively had in my locker because I was selling it out of my locker because I was the kid with not only alcohol, but now I had some drugs. And so I'm selling, I don't know what I'm selling. I could be selling, you know, medicine because my dad had hemorrhoids. I had no idea, but I'm just selling whatever he's got because I'm going to be the kid you go to, you know? And then I remember once someone asking me if I could roll her a joint. I'm like, yeah, I can roll your joint. Never rolled one ever. I'm like, here's your mess, hand her to some, whatever. But I was going to do whatever was going to make you think I was cool. And so the school found these drugs. They called my parents. My parents were really upset with me, probably because I took all their drugs. And they shipped me off to a rehab in Minnesota. So here I am, 14 years old. I've hardly had experience with drugs and alcohol, and I'm in Minnesota. I'm not really in Minnesota. I'm in a hospital that happens to be in Minnesota. And I spent 11 days there until the insurance ran out. And we call that the rehabilitation vacation. And when I came home, I'd given these people a lot of information about my family. And I felt dirty doing it, but I felt good, like I'm going to get them. And I had told this hospital about the sexual abuse. And the thing that I netted from that, from telling them this piece of information, is that they sent family services to my house. And I didn't know they were coming. And I remember one day walking downstairs, this was after my rehabilitation vacation. At this point, I'm going to AA meetings with other kids my age, smoking cigarettes, reading the 12 steps, doing nothing, not understanding it, not getting it, not attaching myself to adults, sitting on the outside. And I wasn't ready. I wasn't cooked all the way. And I kind of knew it. So I walk downstairs in my parents' house, and they're sitting at the kitchen table with this stranger. I'm like, I don't know. Is that a realtor? Are we moving? Like, I have no idea what's going on. And they're sitting with this woman. And then, you know, I had stepped into the room and she asked if she could speak to me. And I was like, sure, you could speak to me. I'll speak to anybody. I'll tell you anything. And I sit down and I realize who she is. She's from the state and she's going to take me away. And I remember feeling joy, like joy rushed over me, like I can get out of this. Now, I haven't really talked about my family because it doesn't really matter because this stuff's all going on in me. No one outside of me is making me feel bad. I just feel wrong in my skin. You know, there were things going on. You know, my father always had girlfriends and families he took care of, and I thought that was kind of weird. And my mother was really angry all the time, and I thought that was kind of awful. But I wanted so badly to not be part of this family. I believed kind of that I belonged to another family and somebody switched me at birth. So this woman asks me all of these questions about the sexual abuse, and my thought here is they're going to take me and put me with another family, and things are going to be fine. And they didn't, and actually my family got really angry at me for giving away a family secret. And up until that point, I didn't know that my family didn't know about this family secret. I thought that they didn't know about it, and it turns out that they did. And this was the shame. So they didn't take me away. I was pretty disappointed. And that meant I had to stay with Ron and Amelia for all eternity. At that point, I stopped going to meetings because, you know, I was doing all these things to get a better family. And that didn't happen. So I don't remember the next time I picked up. I just remember all of a sudden I had picked up. And here I am now. I'm in high school. I'm failing out of high school. For some reason, I became my high school mascot because I thought that would look really good on a college application. Grades meant nothing, but look, I wore a bumblebee uniform and people threw hot dogs at me. And so this is going to be, I'm instantly going to get into a great college. And I'm going to all the parties. I am drinking pretty heavily. I'm drinking probably weekends, then it became Thursdays and weekends, but you know, I'm not really present. I'm cutting school. I'm getting high in the parking lot. I'm doing all the things I'm not supposed to do. I'm driving to school every day and I don't have a parking permit. So I'm getting a $25 ticket every single day. And that ticket goes right to my parents and I don't care about them. So that's fine. And they have money and they can take care of that. And so I'm doing all these things and, I end up failing out of high school. And I didn't know that I failed out of high school until the day I was supposed to graduate high school. And I go to high school that day and I'm standing with all of my peers and we're doing this. I don't know if any of you have an experience of high school like this, but you practice graduating. It's like when you practice getting married, whatever. So we practice graduating and I'm standing in line and I walk up and the principal looks at me and he's like, DeSena, you don't graduate. I'm like, okay. I don't know about this. I don't know why I thought I would graduate. I never really went to class. So I'm like, oh, okay, I don't graduate. So they walk me into the school, and there's my father. And I'm looking at my dad. I'm like, this can't be good, you know. So I'm getting this bad piece of information, and daddy's here, so this can't be good. And I see him at the end of a hallway, and he's talking to my English teacher, and I watch him wind up his hand like he's going to punch the guy. And I'm like, this is going to be great. And it was the first time I saw my father take up for me in any way. And then as I got closer, I heard him. And he said to my teacher, look at her. She's nothing. And she's never going to be anything. Just let her graduate. Like, get her. And I think he must have been thinking I'm going to help her. But I wore that for a long time. And I blamed my father for a lot of things. And that's part of, you know, I think a lot of us do that. So I didn't graduate high school. And I ended up going to summer school my senior year. And then I graduated in August. And my school nurse, when I went to pick up my diploma, ran out in the hallway. And she's like, congratulations. I got handed my diploma by my school nurse. It was a very surreal experience. And then I walked out of the building with my diploma, and I thought, what now? And then I probably drank. I don't remember. At this point, I'm piling up relationships with not only boys, but men, married men, anyone, any man who would give me some sort of attention, because I had this confusion about love and sex and what those things mean. And I have nothing. I have nowhere to go. I'm now a high school graduate. Don't know how that really happened. And by the way, if you don't know this, if you take a summer school class, it is much easier than anything they did throughout the school year. And I thought to myself, I should have been doing this the whole time. So I knew that I'd built myself up a really nice art portfolio. You know, I did a lot of drawing and photography and things because I wasn't going to school and I was bored. There's only so much TV you can watch. And this was back in the dark ages when you had to actually turn the dial on the TV to watch a different channel. And so I had built this portfolio, and I thought, I'm going to go to art school. And I got accepted to one of the best art schools in the country because my daddy had a blank check. So it really was not on my own merit. And they sent me, and they let me go. And I had this sense of freedom. And I failed my first 2 years of college. And I was drinking and driving and moving from place to place and in and out of relationships and no relationship with my family whatsoever. And then I got sober. So I got sober when I was 20. I'm 44 years old, and I got sober when I was 20. And I only went to women's meetings and gay men's meetings because I knew that I was doing something wrong with sex and men. There's something wrong happening for me. And I was always very connected to the sexual abuse in my life, but I never knew what to do with it. But I knew that if I had gone into the rooms of AA with men, that I was just going to have sex with all of them. And I even tried to work that out in some gay men's meetings, and they weren't really into it. But, so I'm going to meetings, and someone suggests to me, now here I am, I'm a junior in college, living in Manhattan, going to meetings in Manhattan. It's a great place to get sober, I think. This is what I'm thinking at the time. And someone suggests to me that I get a sponsor. And I don't really know what that means, but okay. And so I choose this woman. Her name is Kitty, and that is why I chose her, because meow. So this woman, Kitty, and I have nothing in common with Kitty. Kitty is a heroin addict. She's a Hell's Angel. But she had said in a meeting once that her father was a famous pediatrician, and I'm like, I'm a kid. She might get me. And so I'm going to all these meetings, and I'm sharing, and I'm crying, and I'm talking about stuff and my daddy and just blah. And Kitty says to me, we got to do the steps. So let's just do step four. I'm like, okay. Like, this is how we do this. I'm doing what this lady says to me because her name is Kitty and she's got a daddy who's a famous pediatrician. And I think what struck me about that was like later on she'd said to me, my father's a famous pediatrician, but he knows nothing about children. And I didn't hear that part. So she sits me down and she's like, just write down everything you've done and then we're going to talk about it and everything's going to be good. And I'm like, all right, Kitty, this is how I do this. And so we did. We sat down and I told her everything I had done. I don't really know what I had done to that point, but it was just a list. And I read it to her and she's like, great, how do you feel? And I'm like, I feel like I just read you a list. But I was like, I feel great. I didn't. Nothing had changed. There was no anything that occurred for me. And then none of the other steps. And I never opened the book. So this is the best part. Like, I'm doing this work with Kitty, and I have a big book, and the binding is perfect. There's nothing written in it. I don't know what this book says. I'm also, 20 years old. So I end up graduating college 2 years later with honors. I'm still in the program, going to meetings. And the day I graduate college, I moved to the city of Philadelphia, the day I graduate. I'd been in a relationship with a boy. And in the city of New York with millions and millions of people, what if I run into him? So let me move to Philly. And I did that. and I stopped going to meetings completely. So I'm going to meetings at, from the time I'm 20 till the time I'm 22. And I think I'm getting some stuff, but I'm surrounded by people in the program, and maybe I have a shot. You know, maybe something's going to attach itself to me. But I stopped going to meetings. And it was almost immediate that I started to recognize the pain I was in. And I remained sober for a total of 17 years without any sobriety in my life, with no God. And this is the part that hurts so much to even say. I can feel myself salivate because I look at those 17 years and I think, oh, if only you knew, if only you had some information. And so I moved to Philadelphia and I pretend to have a job. I don't really have a job, but rent is so cheap. And at one point I started telling my brother I couldn't pay my phone bill and he would pay it for me. And I'm working for this photographer part-time and I'm making like a couple of $100 a week and I am really not surviving, but I'm not asking anyone for help. But I'm also dying. And I'm alone and I'm lonely. And, you know, no one had cell phones, and if I wanted to make a call to somebody, I'd have to wait, you know, till I got home. But I still wasn't reaching out to anybody, and nothing was changing in my life except for this pit of pain. So then I get this job at this school teaching art to little kids, and because I'm going to be an artist and I'm going to be a teacher, and these are the things I'm going to do. And this woman sets me up on this date with this man, who's currently my ex-husband. And, you know, last time I spoke, I had mentioned him. And I said, God rest his soul, and the man is alive. So I feel bad about that. But now whenever I say his name, I do say God rest his soul, because his soul is aching. And we can talk about that a little later. So I'm now 24 years old, and I'm marrying this man. And I don't want to. And I know I don't want to, but I'm in so much pain. And I think to myself, I've got no solution. And I've got no booze, so let me marry you. And I married him. And the day I married him, I had a conversation with my father, and he said to me, as soon as you're ready, you come to me. He knew that eventually it was going to end. I didn't know that it was going to take 14 years, but he knew that eventually this was going to end. And so here I am, and I'm struggling through this relationship with this man, and something's not right, and I'm blaming him. You're not good enough. You don't make enough money. You're not supporting me well. You don't love me enough. You are not right. And so then I made the decision to make it right. I was going to have a child. And I worked hard to have this child. I don't know if you know how to work hard to have a child. I kept having sex with him. And I thought, if I just keep doing this and we have a child, everything's going to be fine. And then life is going to look the way it's supposed to look. And I'm really big on showing you how perfect it is. And it looked good. It did. Our life looked good from the outside. And I'm dying. And I have zero God. I have no alcohol, and I don't feel love for this person I've chosen to take as my hostage. And so I get pregnant, and in 1998, I had this beautiful little girl, and she is a beautiful little girl. My daughter is a card-carrying member of this club as well, which is kind of cool. She's 16 years old, and I pray about that. And we can talk about that later. So I have this baby, and I think this baby is going to fix my life. And this baby, of course, doesn't fix my life. And here I am. I'm a stay-at-home mother. I have no friends. I have no family. I have no God, and I have no solution, and I have no alcohol. And it's getting progressively worse. And so we decide we're going to move out of Philadelphia, and we're going to move to Bucks County, because that's what's good for children. Bucks County is awesome for kids. So we moved to now this place that is so conservative, and I have absolutely no friends, nobody, and I am stuck at home with a two-year-old. And I don't know if you've ever spent a lot of time with a two-year-old, but there's not a whole lot going on there. And I used to call my mother, and I'd be like, Mom, she's awful. You don't know what she did. She's like, she's two. What are you talking about? I'm like, no, she's a life suck. And she was a life suck to me. I didn't really want to be a mother. I didn't want to be a wife. I didn't want to be a mother. I didn't want to live in suburbia. And I'm all these things because this is going to make me happy. And so I'm miserable. This man knows I'm miserable. He knows it's his fault because I keep telling him. My daughter is now starting to feel like it's her fault. And the solution is now to have another one of them. Because another one is going to really fix the problem. We're going to have the perfect family. There's going to be all of these people in my house. And they're going to love me. And I'm going to feel whole. And there'll be a solution. And it's just, I'm going to keep putting people in my life until this gets fixed. And I'm going to make people. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make people. And this is going to fix my life. And so I have my son. And now I'm looking at this two-year-old. And I'm looking at this man. And I'm looking at suburbia. And I'm like, oh, this isn't fixed. And that's when the bottom really started dropping out for me. And I thought I had gone crazy. And I started seeking the help of therapists and medicine and anything to take. And I started taking lots of antidepressants, and it did. It picked me off the bottom. Now you have to remember, this is a 17-year stint of sobriety with no sobriety, no solution, nothing. I've got nothing. I took away my booze, and I have nothing. But I have these people, and I have friends, and I have all these things. And what happens is I'm this roller coaster of emotions, and I'm taking pills, and it's not helping. It's picking me off the bottom. Like, every day, I don't want to throw myself off a bridge, but I do want to die. But I'm not going to die because I'm taking these pills. And so there's this moment I remember. I had asked my husband for a divorce the first time right after my second child was born, and he got into a terrible car accident, and I felt like, okay, now I have a purpose. I'm going to nurse this man back to health. He doesn't have full use of one of his arms because of that accident. It was really bad, and I was like, okay, I'm going to make this work now because I feel like I love you. There were 2 days in my life that I actually felt complete joy and utter love, and those were the days that my children were born, and I remember feeling a God experience, but I couldn't continue to have babies because eventually my body would fall apart and I'd run out of cash. So, and then I really at some point stopped wanting to have sex with that man. So God rest his soul. And so I remember sitting on my sofa with my best friend at the time and crying and just saying to her, I just need help. I just need help. I'm so unhappy. Just help me get happy. And then I was explaining to her why all these things around me, what were the things that were making me unhappy. He makes me unhappy because he's this. And this house makes me unhappy because it's not enough. And my parents are this. And my siblings are this. And all the people in this town are horrible. And it's all you. Because I don't have God. I don't have a solution. And I don't have alcohol. So I got nothing. I got nothing but I have all this responsibility and I don't want any of it. So I'm going to fast forward. So that went on for a couple of years, just begging people to help me and crying and having people tell me that I'm bipolar. And I'm thinking to myself, good, bipolar. Bipolar is kind of bad. Like, I don't want to be crazy. But I'm like, crazy is so much better than sick, you know, like alcoholically sick or devoid of God. Now, at this point, I know God doesn't exist. I don't care about God. God is for losers, and I want nothing to do with it. We can fast forward to the end of that 17 years. I'm 37 years old. I have a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old. And I decide I'm going to drink. And the way I decided I'm going to drink is I'm also going to save my marriage. So I'm going to take this man who I blame. And I have amends about that, and we're going to talk about that too. So I take this man that I blame, and I'm like, I'm going to take you to a wine festival so you can drink. And I will just be there enjoying this wine festival because people who don't drink go to wine festivals. That's what we do, right? So I make this plan, and we're going to go to Maryland, And we're going to go to this great wine festival on an island. It's very cool. It's very popular. It's a very popular, wonderful thing to do. And I'm, oh, this is so cool. I don't know anything about wine. You know, when I stopped drinking wine coolers, but not wine. So we go to Maryland to this wine festival. And the first day of the festival, I walk in and it's tents. It's big tents and there's cheese and there's wine. And I look at my ex-husband, who was my husband at the time, and I say to him, what do you think if I have a glass of wine? And he's like, well, Justine, you haven't had a drink in 17 years. You're probably good now. I'm like, thank you. I'm probably good now. And so I was like, I'll just have one here, just one glass. He's like, all right. I was like, and they have these spittoons. I'll just spit it out. I just want to taste it. He's like, that's great. And you can taste what wine is like, and you can get to know wine. I'm like, I'm going to get to know the grape. So I take that first sip of wine, and I'm like, I am not spitting this out. I have worked too hard to be 17 years sober. I'm calling it sober, and I'm going to have this wine because I earned it. And I take the wine, and I'm like, this tastes like, I don't know. I don't like this, but all of a sudden, I'm warm. I'm like, I'm warm. It's over. It is over. All of that pain is gone in a flash. And so I spent 3 days completely obliterated. My favorite part of that wine festival was craft beer. Someone had the nerve to have a craft beer booth set up for the losers at this wine festival. And that is where I spent most of my time because I didn't, you know, my last experience of a beer was like a Budweiser. And now they had flavors and hops and barley. And I could tell you all about it now because I'm going to become a beer connoisseur. But understand this, I'm only drinking at this wine festival. And then I get home. Now, I only drank during this festival, obliterated for 3 days. We're driving home, and I'm looking at my ex-husband, and I'm like, this was the best weekend we've ever had, because now I have a solution. I have a solution to this pain. I'm not dying. I'm not dying. For the first time in 17 years, I don't want to die. This was short-lived, but I didn't want to die. And so we get home, and I look at my ex-husband. I'm like, that's our secret. And he's like, that's a great secret. We'll keep that secret. And then the next day, I got a bottle of wine. And I'm like, we're just going to be secretive about this in the house. And he's like, that's a great idea. And so at night with dinner, we're going to have 2 glasses of wine. But when you go to work during the day, I'm going to drink an entire bottle of wine that you don't know about. But that's what I'm doing. And now, and because I've got solution, right? I got these 2 kids running around. You know, I have a swimming pool, and I'm drunk. So everyone's alive now, so we're all good. But, you know, there was potential for death, and I did not care. And so we're getting to this place, and all of a sudden we're having a lot of sex, and we're having a lot of booze, and now my family knows. And it comes out as a secret. Like, it's like when you tell them that you're pregnant. I'm pregnant. I was like, hey. And I'd be standing at a family party with a beer in my hand, and they'd be like, how's that working out for you? You okay? I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. Things are good. You know, I had 17 years. I'm not really an alcoholic. I didn't drink for 17 years on my own accord. Look at me now. I've got this. And they're like, you got this. Things are good. So I had my whole family on board with me that I'm not an alcoholic. How quickly we forgot that I had some friend in the bathroom 20 years ago that my mom thought was dead. But that's all gone because nobody, she's much older now, so her memory's lapsed. And so now I'm drinking. My family's okay with it. My ex-husband's okay with it. I've got all my friends on board. The kids are seeing happy mommy. And something happened in our house. We had a big water loss in our house, and we decided we're going to rebuild our house. And, you know, now I've got another reason to stay with this man. I'm drunk. I don't care. I don't care who I'm living with. And, you know, the kids are dressed. And now I'm getting involved with the kids now because publicly I don't have to be in pain because I can be drunk and nobody knows. I don't know. Who knows? And we decide we're going to paint the interior of our house and rebuild it together. And it was a fun, challenging thing. And, you know, it's like I have another project. I'm filling the hole, right? I'm filling this empty hole. Now I got booze. I've got projects. I've got kids. And I'm a brownie troop leader. Oh, my God. So I'm doing all these things that are filling this empty place that are, again, not God, right? But everything seems to be working out. So I'm painting the house, and the inside of the house while my ex-husband's at work, and he calls me during the day. I'm like, hey, come home early. You know, I'm painting the house today, and I've got a bottle of wine. Why don't you come home early? He gets home early. This man comes home or leaves work early to be with me because he thinks he's getting some, and I am passed out on the sofa by 4:30 every single day. And so now this is progressing every single day. And then it all starts to go south. Like, oh my God, I actually don't want to be with you. And I don't want these kids. And I don't know how to tell you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to find another man. And I find this other man, and I put him in my life. And I did try to convince myself for a really long time that I didn't do this, but I did. And there are much better ways to leave someone you don't want to be with than hurt them. But I'm not capable of that. So I meet this man, and I had pretended to start fighting with my husband because we weren't really fighting. We were just kind of existing. And I now have this man fill in this hole, right? And I go out on dates with him, and then my ex-husband finds a text in the middle of the night. Now I'm living in another room because I'm leaving you, sort of. He finds a text in the middle of the night and comes into the room that I'm in, and he shows it to me, and the next day I left. So that day I leave. I'm now essentially homeless. I've abandoned my children. I've abandoned my home. And I've hurt this man tremendously. And I don't care, because it's all their fault. So now I'm in this relationship with this man. I'm living in one room. My children come to my apartment, and I don't want them touching anything because mommy's now a single woman. And this went on for another 4 years, being with this man, hurting my children, putting him first, not my family first, and going through a pretty messy divorce. And I'm drinking, and everything's fine. And so I make this decision. I'm going to travel the world. I'm going to travel the world and experience life for the first time. And I've been to, this was, I guess, 6 years ago. I've been to 5 countries. I can't tell you anything about them. I can tell you where to drink in those countries. I can tell you their best booze, but I can't really tell you anything about these countries. I can't tell you anything about anything I did during this time. I can tell you that I was still in pain because now the booze isn't working and I'm dying. I've lost all of my friends except for 1.5. I get out of that relationship and I decide to start online dating because online dating is now going to fix this problem that I have. And I meet this really great alcoholic. And I meet him based on the fact that he has no God in his life, because I actually chose that as one of the things about me in my profile. There's no God. So I don't want you to have a God. And so I get this guy in my life and he's got no God, and together we have no God and we're drinking and things are really good. And then all of a sudden abuse starts happening, and physical abuse, and the police are involved, and my children are watching this, and I don't care. I'm going to fast forward and get to the really good meat of this story, because I'm running behind. My bottom is a fiery crash of horribleness. I stabbed this man. He beat me. The police were involved. My daughter witnessed it. He left, and I went to a meeting, and he went to a meeting somewhere else. So I walk into this meeting, and I know what I'm going to get. I know I'm going to go into this meeting, and there's going to be sober people in this meeting, and I am at my bottom. I've lost my family. I've lost all my friends. They've told me I'm a drunk, and they don't want to watch me die. So I go into a meeting, and I see this man, and he says to me, "This is a great meeting. You need to be here." And I'm like, "Whatever you tell me. I'll do whatever you tell me." And he says, "I want you to find somebody in this meeting." And I'm like, "Okay, I'll find somebody in this meeting." And I'm not, this is not my intention. I'm not going to do it. And I hear this woman speaking, and her name is B. And B is on fire. And I look at B and I'm like, "I want that." And I walk up to B at the end of the meeting and I'm like, "Hey, B, my name's Justine. I need your help." She's like, "Who told you to come talk to me?" I'm like, "I don't know." So she said, "Fine, come to my house Monday night. You and I, we're doing steps 1 through 3. And I'm like, "All right, whatever you got." Because I'm dying. I've lost everything. I have no family. I have no friends. I am a drunk. I drink at 9 a.m. I drink at 12 in the afternoon. I drink as soon as I get home from work. I'm drunk every day. So I go to B's house on a Monday night, and it's the night that the man in my life has gone to jail. And I say to her, I can't come. He's in jail. She's like, you can't help him. He's in jail. So come to my house. And I go to her house and we do steps 1 through 3. And all of a sudden, there's something happening to me. And when we get to 3, she said to me, do you know God? And I was like, nope. She's like, do you believe I know God? And I said, yep. And she said, do you want to borrow my God? I'm like, yes, I want to borrow your God. And so she lent me her God. And then she sends me home and she said, I want you to write all this stuff. And she explains to me out of this book, out of this awesome book, how I'm going to do step 4. And I go home and I do it. And I come back the next week and we read it. And she's like, no big deal. And then we move on. We're in 5, right? And she's like, I'm like, it's no big deal. She's like, it's no big deal. I'm like, okay, this is great. And all of a sudden, the weight of the world is off my shoulders. I've told her everything I can remember, everything, because I so desperately don't want to feel this empty hole of God, right? And that's, I'm learning that this is what it is, right? I'm learning that this is about God. And she sends me home to do 6 and 7, and I don't get 6 and 7. I still don't get 6 and 7. I pretend I get 6 and 7, and if you guys can tell me about 6 and 7, please do, because I am willing. And then we're doing 8, and we're doing 8 off of 4 and 5, and I didn't ever know anything about that, because Kitty didn't tell me, right? So I'm back with B, and we're doing 4 and 5. And we're doing 8 and 9. And 9, I'm making amends, and I get this. And I get what this means, and I get what this means to me, and I get this what this means to you, because we're really just preparing me to live in 10, 11, and 12, because that's where I need to be. I made an amends to my parents first. It was the easiest one to do. They tried to let me off the hook, and I didn't let it happen. The amends to my children started as a mommy's really sorry that your life sucked. I'm so sorry. And then I did it again by writing them letters. They keep them by their bedsides. They're very clear. They're very concise. And they are not a promise, but the willingness to go forward loving you the way I'm supposed to. I made an amends to my best friend, and we are not friends to this day, but we have a loving understanding. And the amends I made to her, we're sitting and I'm doing this and she's crying. And she said, I was so nervous. Were you nervous? And I said, no, I'm not nervous. And she said, why aren't you nervous? I said, because I didn't get hurt by you. You got hurt by me. And I'm getting this and I'm understanding it. And every day I'm having a little bit of an experience of what God is. And God exists in me when I am thinking about you. God does not exist in me when I'm thinking about me. When I'm thinking about me, I black out. I black out emotionally when I am in my own head. But when I'm in this, and I'm reaching my hand out, and I'm living in 10, 11, and 12, I am in the presence of God. You know, I come to these meetings, and I think about sharing this experience with you, and I think about those 17 years in this program, believing I'm in this program, believing I am a sober person with absolutely no God, it does not work. The years that I drank from the time I was 37 until the time I was 44 were painful. The 17 years before that were worse, but there was less destruction. It's all bad when you don't dive deep into God. And I don't like the word God, and it's not really what it is for me. It's not a churchy thing, but I don't know how else to describe what happens in here. I don't know how to describe, and I touch it. When I touch this part of my body, it feels so good. It feels so good to know that God is inside of me. And the greatest part of it is God is inside of all of us all the time. It's there all the time. It's just, I just kept putting kids and husbands and things and men and hate and, you know, countries in here, filling this, and wine festivals I didn't belong at, you know, but the tents were fabulous, you know, and all these things I'm stuffing inside of myself because I don't want to let this out. And when I let this out, you see it in me. And the reason I know you see it in me is because I see it in you. And I look in this room and I see these people that I love, and there are some people here tonight that I look at you and I just full. I'm full. I love you. The one thing these rooms give to me that I don't get in other rooms, because I can't walk into my office and be like, I love you, and it's all here. They'll be like, what are you doing? You know, is I get to have this experience with you guys, and you get it, and I can tell you my dirtiest, darkest, deepest secrets. I can tell you that I've slept with men for drugs And you don't go, whore. Well, you might go, whore, but I get it. You know, and I can tell you that I'd rather live in my car than with my own children. And you get it. I can tell you these dark, terrible things. I can tell you that I've suffered abuse and I've used that information for my benefit. I can tell you these things and you don't judge me because you know that because I'm doing this and I'm reaching my hand out and I'm begging you to let me in your life. I'm begging you to let God work through me to pass on this information. I'm begging you because I know my willingness is keeping me alive, right? And I know God right in here and this whole being full is keeping me alive. I see it when I walk into these rooms. I didn't see it for so long, and I didn't see it in these rooms because I didn't want to. You know, sometimes I'll say that I'd go into meetings and no one would talk about the big book. Everyone talks about the big book. I didn't want to hear about the big book. I didn't want to open. I had it. Did you get yourself a big book? Yeah, I got myself a big book. I read the stories in the back. And, you know, and there was one story when in the, I think, an edition or two ago called Every Day Was Wash Day. And I tried to identify with the woman who was doing her family laundry and leaving her booze in the washer. I'm like, I don't really identify with her, but Every Day Was Wash Day is my favorite story in this book. I don't know why. I think the stories are great for some people, and I think they mean something, and I don't think I've actually opened my book to those stories. I know that on page 44, there's a couple of questions, and those questions I can answer emphatically on this person. I'm in this book. I'm in this book. I belong in this book, but I'm so in 10, 11, and 12. And I'm always willing to revisit all the others, having issues with the God stuff because of the word, but God's there. When I think about my life and I think about what those 17 years were like without a solution, and then those years after those 17 years with the solution that tried to kill me, my gratitude for this opportunity is astounding. And I look at me and I think, if this idiot can do it, anybody can do it. When people say to me, the big book's not for me, and I was like, no, it is. It's for all of you. If I'm having this experience and you crazy people are having this experience by doing this work, anybody can. Anybody can. I thank God every day. I pray to God every day. I do my third step prayer first thing in the morning every single day. I'm going to continue to do that. I'm going to continue to put my hand out. I'm going to continue to thank you and have that experience of love with you. And thank you so much for your time.